Nip nerp.
Nip nerp
D three S river.
S river. Nice. This is The End User, episode 127 for Tuesday, March 12th, reverse 3D printing. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, we have South by Southwest going on in Austin right now. I think there are a couple of Digital Media Zone people down there, aren't there?
Yeah, I think Richard is down there right now. I think he's the only one, though, isn't he?
Yeah, I guess he's the only one as far as I know. So we've been hearing periodic updates from him, but the biggest news to come out of South by Southwest so far is the new Maker Industries 3D scanner.
Yes, 3D scanner, not printer. We're used to seeing 3D printers abound, but this thing is actually scanning objects and then using a 3D printer to print them out, right?
Right. So hopefully the way it works is you can just get the scanner, scan something, and then it'll automatically be able to make copies of whatever that thing is, right? There's no reformatting or transferring or compressing in order to be able to turn an existing object into a printed object.
At least that's what they say. I you know, it's hard to get a feel for how well the thing actually works, but if it actually works the way they say it works, then this is fantastic. And I've got to think that it doesn't.
Yeah, it probably won't. And who knows how accurate it will even be in scanning anything. We don't really have any details about it, price availability, how it's going to work or anything like that. All they've done is announce it and announce that it makes sense for them to do this, which, okay, sure. And it can scan bread box size objects.
Now, what I do think would be a little useful is to scan something into a CAD file and then actually edit it. Just take it as a starting template for what you're trying to do, and then go and edit it and make it right, and then you can go and print it out. That would make a little bit more sense to me, at least as they're kind of dipping their toe in the water of getting this kind of scanning capability going.
Yeah, I'm sure that you'll be able to do that, to be able to edit it from the computer before you print out a copy. So we don't know anything about it, but it's a pretty new idea, at least in terms of actual products.
Yeah, it's tantalizing, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
We're starting to catch up with you, the Futurist Prime.
Well, yeah, I know.
So we'll be there any minute now, I suppose.
Yeah, keep telling yourself that.
So,
right,
arriving,
so since we don't have any other details about the MakerBot 3D scanner, I guess we can move on.
Yeah, arriving any minute now is going to be the Samsung Galaxy S4, and they've published this kind of teaser video, which is a little lame to me. They don't really give you any details. It's just a kid looking into a box. So what is actually happening, though, is they leaked the pictures of the device so we could actually see it. And so that kind of looks interesting, but I can't wait for them to actually talk about what is inside of this thing.
Yeah, I hope to hear that, too. You know, something tells me it's going to be another super thin 5-inch 1080p screen, device with a better camera. And so basically everything else that we saw at Mobile World Congress 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, they've got we're at the point in smartphones' lifetime where we're really just iterating on things, aren't we? I mean, we're not seeing huge innovation. We're seeing an iterative approach to things where, yeah, okay, the screen's better. We've got 1080p phones out in the wild now, and the cameras are getting better and that kind of thing. The lenses on the cameras are getting better, and all the hardware is you know, getting better over time, but we're not seeing that huge iPhone style leap that was so exciting, or even like the Pre that I always bring up in the same breath. That's a little different.
Yeah, I think all the rest of the stuff is going to be a few years away. Remember, for our kicker a few weeks ago, we saw that transparent phone prototype.
Right, so that'll be cool. And the Leap Motion Plus, I think we're going to see some kind of new interface within, I don't know, 5 years? Isn't that what they always say?
Right, 5 years is the development cycle.
Yeah, it's either 5 years or the next funding round.
Right. Whether iterative or revolutionary, we will definitely get more details about the Samsung Galaxy S4 for our show next week.
Definitely so. So I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be... very, very exciting.
All right. Well, here's something that's not iterative. We've been talking about how Windows RT didn't have flash content enabled except in certain use cases. Can you tell us about what those use cases were?
Yeah, well, they had a whitelist of sites that they knew were okay to run on that device. And
all right. Well, I guess they've expanded the whitelist to all sites.
Yeah,
Flash
more or less.
Is now going to run on Windows RT.
Right. So what they're doing here is they're switching away from so-called whitelist to a blacklist. So they have a list, a curated list of sites that they know do not work well in the Windows 8 experience. And for those sites, they are blocking the use of Flash. And then for all of the other sites, it's open season and they can do whatever they want.
Well, that's really awesome. I mean, that's going to give the Surface RT tablet a big advantage on the iPad.
Yeah, because no matter what you think of Flash, because I go to a Flash site and I'm really not enthused by using it. But at least it lets me get at the content, right? And it may not be the best user experience compared to HTML5, but I think having it on is kind of the right decision. Or at least,
yeah, there's just a lot of content that you can't get to except right. through Flash.
Right. And then, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to pull out your laptop, thus obviating why you have a tablet in the first place. So I think this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. It'll probably kill some people's batteries a little bit faster. And I bet some people will be more annoyed than happy that there's Flash.
Yeah,
but those people, hopefully they will be able to disable Flash on their RT tablet.
Yeah, you could easily take the other tact with that, and I wouldn't object to that in the slightest. But it's definitely a leg up over similar tablets. You know, the iPad is never going to do Flash, right?
Right. The iPad is just going to keep hoping Flash goes away forever.
Yeah, and I got to think eventually it will, but we're still, even now, we're still a very, very long way away from that.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, there are websites that are still around and unchanged from the days before Flash. So what makes you think that Flash will ever be completely gone?
Well, so if you have a Microsoft Surface and you would like to test this out, I suppose you can go to Zombocom. Because that was the one of the earliest incarnations of Flash that I remember. So... you can truly do anything with Zombocom.
Anything is possible.
So the Windows 8 desktop version of Internet Explorer, just to confuse everyone, is going to work for all sites. There is no blacklist or whitelist. It will just work. And the Metro version will have a blacklist of sites that they know doesn't work. And it's a little bit different on RT. The desktop and Metro versions are both basically the same. So you can use all sites except for the ones they know don't work.
Well, that makes sense to automatically block the ones they know don't work.
Yep. All right. Well, let's move away from the Surface and let's move into something we don't normally talk about, which is entertainment boxes. I guess we talked about the Roku for a while last week.
Yeah, we talk a lot about entertainment boxes. We just don't usually talk about TiVo.
Yeah, TiVo has released their the TiVo Mini, and Benton Drawbaugh has a review up on Engadget HD, and he does a really good job over there. So follow through in the show notes and click through to read all the details. But basically, it's this small triangular box that you can put on your TV, and it acts kind of like an extender for the TiVo Premiere. So this thing doesn't have any tuners in it. You use it to stream the video from your TiVo Premiere to a second television. So it's a second box, as it were.
Right. Now, this is something that you could do with TiVo before. If you had a TiVo Premiere in one room and another current TiVo in another room, you could play DVR'd content from one TiVo to the other. But you still had to pay for two full TiVo DVRs. The TiVo Mini just gives you that streaming option without having to have the entire large box and the monthly fees that go along with it. But it's still going to cost $6 a month plus $99 to start, or you can buy it outright for $249. And I think that this is just straight up price gouging.
Yeah, it's crazy. Why would I pay $6 a month for a device that streams locally over my network? I really cannot wrap my head around that. I suppose it's a kind of subsidy model or something like that, but I just cannot wrap my head around that. That's very weird.
This is basically the size of a Roku or an Apple TV, and it has fewer connectivity options. It should cost $100 and no more.
Yeah. But if you are a TiVo person and you are using the TiVo, this makes some sense, right? It makes way more sense than having multiple TiVo premieres in the house.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think that if you are a savvy TiVo user, you could figure out a way to stream your TiVo content to another device. I mean, they support it for computers and many mobile devices already, just not for other TVs unless you have this or a second DVR. But it shouldn't be too hard to be able to do that, and you could probably do it for cheaper than this.
Yeah, I got to think so. So there's another curiosity is that there's no Wi-Fi support in this device, and I got to wonder if that's just because they were having trouble with the bandwidth or something like that. It's a little odd. I mean, wireless N, particularly on 5 gigahertz, has plenty of bandwidth.
Yeah, we'll never know the reason for them not including wireless N in this thing. But again, I'm going to go with price gouging. That's just my operating theory.
So you've got a couple ways of hooking this thing up to your network. You can either use Ethernet or you can use the coax hookup on the back, which is a little interesting because it's not coax for your cable box. It uses the MoCA protocol to share the tuners. And
oh, so it... If the one TiVo, if your main TiVo Premiere is hooked up to coax and Ethernet, then you can share that connection through coax on
the
Mini?
Well, yeah, you stream the content over coax to the Mini, yes.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. That makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, I suppose it's a little confusing if you've never done that kind of thing before. I haven't done it in my experience before using MoCA over coax, but... It's just another option, but it's a little confusing to look on the back of the box and see the coax input and not plug your cable connection into it.
Right.
So Diehard in the chat there brings up the fact that it has component video out. And yeah, that's depending on what your situation is, that is can be incredibly helpful. The Roku that we talked about last week has removed all of its analog connections, so they're diverging a little bit here.
Yeah, although it's a little proprietary connector there for a component video, but we're not griping about the video out, you know, the outputs. We're griping about the inputs.
Right, and we're also griping about the fact that it doesn't have HDMI CEC, so you can't control it over that protocol, which is a little bit disappointing. So what's a little confusing is it has Hulu Plus, YouTube, and Spotify, but it does not have Netflix. So it's kind of the opposite of the Roku that we talked about.
That is so strange because I can easily imagine someone who pays for both TiVo and Netflix, but I cannot imagine the consumer who's paying for TiVo and Hulu Plus.
Yeah, I'm imagining a world where you're paying $6 a month for your TiVo and whatever it is, $8 a month for Hulu Plus, and another $8 or $9 for Netflix. That would not be too fun.
Well, some people have the funds for that. Some people really like entertainment, but I still don't understand why Hulu Plus was a priority for this device.
Yeah, hard to say. So I guess the takeaway for me is, if you're a TiVo kind of person, this is a very interesting option for you. But if you're not, then we don't have to pay attention to it.
Yeah, and even if you're a TiVo kind of person, you should think really long and hard before signing up for this for $6 a month.
Yeah, definitely so. All right, with that, let's turn on our afterburners.
All right, so we've got a launch date for the BlackBerry Z10 in the U.S. It'll be available March 22nd. Pre-orders are starting soon, and it will be $200.
And an angry senator, Claire McCaskill, has called out to the FAA to stop the ban on using mobile devices during takeoff, calling it preposterous.
Yeah, this is not going to change anything right away about the ban on mobile devices in planes, but it's a pretty big protest against it. And so we haven't covered much about the launch of the new SimCity game, but it was quite a mess when it launched. There were major server problems, and people were just unable to access the servers and play the game at all. You need to actually have a constant connection to Maxis servers in order to just be able to play the game on your own machine. That's not even if you're trying to play online. You actually have to be online just to play on your own machine. So they have gone ahead and offered a free PC download from their back catalog. So maybe that'll make people feel a little bit better, but probably not. And that's all we're going to say about it.
Yeah, what was it? It was Diablo 3 we talked about previously that did this very same thing. And it's extremely frustrating because if you're not doing the multiplayer dance, I don't think you should have to log into anything to play the game. But it's an example of how not to launch a product, because even though they're requiring you to log into a server, they didn't have the server capacity to handle all the people that were logging on. So you shouldn't have done it in the first place, I think. And even if you're going to do it, you have to plan accordingly. And I guess they got surprised by the amount of traffic they received from it. So they are in damage recovery mode, and hopefully they'll make good on this.
Yeah, the server problems have largely been resolved, but it doesn't prevent future server problems from popping up.
Right.
And Apple has fixed a bug in their iOS App Store. Apparently, the store was not using HTTPS secure protocol since its invention, but now it does. So you are now more secure if you use the iOS App Store.
Yeah, and that's definitely a good thing to add that security over there. And this is something we, ever since FireSheep, we've seen happening over time with Twitter and Facebook, and I think LinkedIn does it now too, and it's time for all the app stores to do it as well.
Well, I'm surprised that you frame it in that light, Chris, because it is a good thing, but more accurately, it's a terrible thing that nobody knew about that's been fixed.
That's been under the covers for a long time now.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Gmail has refreshed their mobile device inbox look, and they are bringing that new look to their mobile web app, as well as eventually their offline version of the regular online Gmail inbox. And so you can go to the show notes and take a look at what the new version will look like.
Yeah, it looks pretty nice. I mean, I'll still be using a mail client of some sort, at least on my smartphone. But that looks kind of interesting, particularly for older emails that are not archived in my client, if you want to go search the server or something like that. I think that makes sense. So something else that makes a lot of sense is Google support will be using Hangouts from now on, so they can screen share and the like. And my question is, Google had support?
Well, it's primarily for Google Apps and business users.
Right. Yeah, they do.
So anybody that is paying for Google Apps for My Domain or they're using Google for their business, those are the primary recipients of this new tech support using Google Hangout.
Yeah,
geez, if you're trying to use Hangout for your business and Hangout isn't working, how do you have a Hangout to solve that problem?
So it's primarily for business and probably for some academic institutions that they're going to be using this. The Google Apps domain thing, they don't really offer a whole lot of support for. You're kind of off on your own to post in the forums. But I guess if you're paying for it as a business customer, you want a little bit more support, and this seems like a fantastic way to do it.
Well, it seems like an integrative way to do it.
Yes, definitely so. And with that, let's turn off the afterburners. Let's relax, have a sip of tea, and get into the end user stories. What do we got going first?
All right. Well, when we talked about the Chromebook Pixel a few weeks ago, we promised that we would talk about the reviews as soon as they came up. So one of our favorite blogs, Ars Technica, has posted a full multi-page review covering the operating system, the device, and everything. And what they say is that it's a great computer. I mean, you definitely get what you pay for in terms of hardware. It is on par in many ways with a current generation MacBook Pro. It has an even higher screen resolution and performance, and then the screen is also touchscreen. But Chrome OS is way behind that operating system. So in terms of functionality, you will get not very much more out of this than you would from a $250 Chromebook, and this one cost more than $1,000 more than that.
Yeah, like we mentioned when the news of the Pixel first came out, I mean, it's just plain confusing. I understand the dream. I get what they're trying to do, but Chrome OS is just not going to do that, I think.
I think Chrome could, because if you get this Chromebook, you'll automatically get operating system updates whenever Google pushes them out. And I think they're definitely going to, in the future, bring more touchscreen and more multi-touch gestures to Chrome OS. And that's going to be especially useful for the Chromebook. Although it's really strange, I think, because so many people already have or will buy these cheapo Chromebooks that don't have a touchscreen, they don't have great trackpads, they don't have these custom Google keyboards, and Google's going to have to develop a whole separate strain of Chrome OS just for the Pixel, and they're going to have to devote a lot of resources to that that could otherwise be spent improving the interface in ways that are applicable to all Chromebooks instead of just this one that probably most people won't buy.
Yeah, and having the touchscreen on there is a little bit confusing because Chrome OS is not a touchscreen OS. I mean, a lot of people look at Windows 8 and it's kind of dual personality of this touchscreen OS and the desktop OS that you're using with a mouse and keyboard perhaps. And Chrome is just not designed for touch in any way. So it's a little weird to have a touchscreen on it. I guess it's not a bad thing to have it in there, and I think you're right that Google's going to kind of iterate over this over time, and it'll get better, and they're going to start to add features for notebooks with touchscreens, and it'll get better over time, but it's just not there. And it's interesting to see them launch this, and it's interesting to note that nobody's going to buy it because it's too expensive, and the only people that are going to be using this are probably Google engineers. For that purpose, you think, well, they wanted a quality machine that runs Chrome OS, and that kind of makes sense to me.
I actually think that Google is going to get a lot of purchases for this, maybe even the majority of non-Google engineer purchases will be someone who buys this and then hacks it to run OS 10 or Windows 8.
Yeah, or Ubuntu. We were talking about the Ubuntu tablet version that was coming out. I could see that being pretty useful with this thing.
Well, Ubuntu is never a majority in any case, but Ubuntu on this would be great. I think this would be a particularly excellent computer for Windows 8.
Right. So I'm really enthusiastic about the hardware. I think it's fantastic, and I just am confused by Chrome OS being on this thing. And I know they weren't going to release this with anything but Chrome OS, but it almost makes me wish they hadn't released it like that. Like, this thing is Chrome OS is too good for this. Or sorry, the other way around. The Pixel is too good for Chrome OS.
Well, I don't think that's going to be a major hindrance. I don't think that the software or the hardware are going to be major impediments to people putting other operating systems on here. And I don't think that the Chrome OS itself is going to be a major hurdle in terms of price for people installing what they want to. I mean, it was a problem with Windows laptops for a long time.
Yeah,
you know,
very true.
When you buy a Windows laptop or a Mac computer, for that matter, you're paying for the software, but you're not really paying all that much to run Chrome OS, you know, when you buy a Chromebook. I mean, you can theoretically run Chromium OS on pretty much any laptop. So I think people will, once all the pathways have been figured out, people will start to buy these to use other operating systems on. And I think we're going to start seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, because the hardware is just so good. You almost can't, you can't play it down for just that one reason.
Yeah, so. Except for the lack of dedicated graphics cards. So pushing that many pixels on another operating system is going to become a challenge. And the base model only has 32 gigabytes of memory.
Yeah, I guess that is pretty short. I mean, Windows itself takes somewhere very shortly south of 14 gig or so.
Yeah, so this is going to be, you know, not a main computer for anybody in any case.
Yeah, definitely. So not for the end user then?
Well, the end user who wants to have a really expensive second computer, it's great for that.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, so my next story this week is a company that's been around for a while called ReadySim. They are based in Canada, but they have just started offering prepaid short-term mobile service in the U.S. This is great for somebody who needs to bring up a second phone, or if they're just visiting the U.S. And they want a cheap and disposable way to get mobile service. And they are offering data. So for $25, you get a week of unlimited voice texting and 500 megabytes of data. And they have other tiers above that as well. I just thought this was really cool because the prepaid mobile space in the U.S. is very underdeveloped when it comes to smartphones.
It's just getting started, isn't it?
Yeah. And so this is a great way if you're here and you really want short-term smartphone data and calling, this is where you need to go. It's not well advertised, but it works.
Yeah, it was, so when I went over to Istanbul in Turkey, I was able to get a SIM. I was able to get data, and I was able to text and talk. And, you know, for, what was it? It was $30 prepaid, and I was able to do all of those things. So this is a market that is terribly underserved in the United States, and it's great to see someone else break into it other than Virgin Mobile.
Yeah, or T-Mobile, which they're going that way. You know, remember, they're trying to get rid of their postpaid contracts altogether.
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of cool to see T-Mobile round that corner and see if they can kind of fill that niche that is popping open right now.
Yeah, but T-Mobile is generally still going on paying for a month or so, and this gives you the option to pay for a week. You can't pay for a day, but there are probably fewer people who are only in the country for a day and really need smartphone service.
Right. So, and our next story is Netflix is going to stop issuing API keys to developers. And if that was insane alien gobbledygook, then what you do need to know is that there will no longer be third-party apps going forward. The ones that are already established can keep using their key I guess until Netflix decides to put the kibosh on that. But going forward, you're not going to be able to get new third-party apps that access your queue and stuff like that. So that's a little disappointing.
It is pretty disappointing, yeah.
Because I used InstantWatcher.com in particular to manage my queue, just because it's so lightweight. They're going to the Netflix website is loading this huge behemoth, and that was just a quick way to go about doing things. So definitely a little disappointed. I wonder if we'll see some kind of backlash, and I wonder if Netflix will care anyway.
I think they probably won't. I mean, Netflix generally has pretty good application and platform support. So they are free to kill their APIs if they want to and try to force people into using the first-party apps. But they're, generally speaking, not bad apps, at least in my experience. I've never managed a Netflix queue. I've never paid for my own Netflix account. So I'm not the one to say so. But I don't think Netflix will care, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I'm disappointed also. The very first comment on the article that we're sharing is, I was in the middle of developing a Windows 8 Netflix app. Darn. Because Netflix doesn't even have a Windows 8 app yet.
But can you still get to, you know, you can just use the website, right?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. They do have a Windows 8 Metro app. I'm wrong. I was thinking you couldn't manage the queue from their app. You only, just like all the other ones, you only get access to the instant stuff, but not the DVD queue management stuff.
I see. So you have to do that from the website.
Right. So if this guy was developing a Windows 8 app, that's exactly what he would have access to through the API. So we're not going to get that, basically.
This stuff is complicated. There should be a podcast just about all the different things you can do with Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix Weekly, perhaps? We should get on that.
Maybe we should, but again, I'm not the most qualified person.
Netflix API Keys Weekly? No, we'll have to stop that.
We would have to stop that podcast right in its tracks.
Every week we get a new API key. No, I think that's going a little bit too hyper niche with the podcast, for sure.
There's no such thing, Chris. No such thing.
All right, well, let's get into it. It looks like you've got a green tech story of the week for us. What do you have?
I do, and this is pretty exciting. So this one is about LED light bulbs, and I've mentioned some of these before, and basically every time a cheaper or better one comes out, I feel like I have to mention it. A few years ago, they were $30 to $40, and we've talked about LED light bulbs that cost $25 or $30 or $50. And before that, they used to be $100 just for one light bulb that socket. There is now a company that is manufacturing and selling $10 LED light bulbs.
Cool.
And they have three different versions. Two of them are 60-watt equivalent, and they only use 50% of the power that an incandescent bulb would use. So it's even better than compact fluorescents, which some of them still cost $10. These are probably not going to be the highest quality bulbs. The light saturation might not be exactly what you want it to. The lifespan of the bulb might be less than a more expensive bulb, but it's $10 for an LED bulb that is going to last longer than any other light bulb that you can buy.
Yeah, by a long shot. So they're breaking these up into their wattage equivalency. So that, what is that? The amount of light it puts out compared
The wattage equivalency is based on the amount of light it puts out, and the wattage equivalent is to an incandescent bulb.
Right.
There's two 60 watts and a 40 watt. Like I mentioned, the two 60 watts, one of them is like a warm white indoor kind of light that a lot of people prefer, and then the other one is more focused on daylight. Again, these are not going to be the highest caliber of light compared to like a GE daylight bulb that looks fantastic but eats up a lot of power and burns out every couple of months. This is going to last 10 years or so, and it will use 15% of the power that an incandescent bulb would do, and probably half the power that a compact fluorescent would use.
It's just kind of funny because on the packaging it says LED bulb 60 watts And you kind of think to yourself, how did they get LEDs to take up 60 watts? That doesn't make sense.
That would be a really, really bright light.
Yeah, that would be some kind of like Hollywood studio light or something. Probably not even.
I'm sure somebody would go for that. You know, I'm sure they'd love it in stadiums and performance spaces.
Yeah, perhaps.
So the company is called Cree, and they are selling them for $10 and up. So I think only the 40 watt is actually $10, but they're still cheaper than any other LED bulb on the market. And again, cheaper than some compact fluorescents.
Cool. All right. Let's get into our tip of the week. How can we make Facebook not suck?
Well, this is great. This came from Jason Kotke at Kotke.org. He found a page that just gives you a stream of the links that your friends have shared. No tweets, no photos, no statuses, just links. And I love this page ever since I found it last week. I don't know if the page is going to stick around when Facebook finally rolls out that redesign that they introduced on this past Thursday, which it also looks great. And you should be able to, with the new design, have more granular control over the types of stuff that you see in your feed. They'll have multiple feeds, actually, and maybe one of them will be for links. But if not, then hopefully this page will still be there, because to just go on Facebook and see the stuff that your friends thought was interesting enough to actually share a link and then be able to see a description of the link and click on it or not click on it just is so much better in terms of the way that you can use Facebook as opposed to just getting sucked up into statuses from cousins or photos of cats.
Not that
there's anything wrong with photos of cats.
Photos of Grumpy Cat specifically.
Grumpy Cat, the guest of honor at South by Southwest.
That's right. Yeah, so this is a pretty cool tip. I have to wonder if it's going to continue to work once they roll out their changes, but it works for me now, and I don't have the changes, so it's tough to say.
Yeah, so there's no easily memorable link for it. It's a string of letters, numbers, and symbols, but we will have the link in our show notes.
Yeah, so follow through to kotke.org and you can check that out. See if you like it. So you've also got an app pick for us on iOS. What do you have for us?
Yeah, I don't remember if we ever talked about Google's Field Trip app. I don't remember reading about it before.
I don't think we did.
It had been available on Android and it's now available on iOS. So it is a travel-oriented virtual tour guide, according to Lifehacker. And it keeps track of your location, and it can send you notifications when you're near something that it thinks you might find interesting. And you can select categories, you know, restaurants, architecture, museums, whatever it is that you're interested in. The app can keep track of that stuff and send you notifications. This is great because I'm actually going to Hawaii in a couple of months, so I was looking for travel apps that could help me out with this. And I was really excited to see that this just came out for iOS. So yeah. Whether you have Android or iOS, sorry, Chris, no Windows Phone 8 app as far as I know. Does Google make Windows Phone apps?
Yeah, I think they made a search app, and they've been really hostile with the YouTube access from Microsoft's YouTube app. So I think they've got at least the search app out there, but I don't think they've got any other useful ones. And I'm looking now in the App Store as we speak, and they have a Google search app, and that's it.
Well, hopefully they'll come out with more stuff like this. But in the meantime, Android and iOS users are good to go. Download
Rejoice.
This and use it the next time you are touring or sightseeing or traveling.
Cool. So you'll get some use out of this. Maybe we should talk about it when you get back from your trip.
Oh, yeah, we definitely will. All right, and finally for our kicker this week, it's a new neighbor. I mean a neighbor. And by neighbor of the sun, I mean two stars that are just discovered that are about 6 light years away, making them 3 doors down. No pun intended.
I think there was a pun intended in that one, but we'll let it go.
So There are two star systems that are between 4 and 6 light years, and this one is the third closest, and it was just discovered. So I think that's really cool. These are brown dwarfs, binary ones that are orbiting each other, and they're only 6.5 light years away from Earth, and we didn't know that they were there because they are not easily visible because they're brown dwarfs. You can only see them in the infrared.
Right, so it doesn't say in the article here, but I've got to imagine they used like the transit method where they had something that was behind it, and then they can see the thing moving in front of it in infrared or something like that. But yeah, what a surprise.
That wasn't quite it because, between here and 6.5 light years, there's not a whole lot of light-emitting stuff. So what they did was there are two infrared surveys of the entire night sky, and comparing those two scans brought up this, these two sets of stars, which they calculated how far away it was, and they came out with about 6.5 light years.
Yeah, so we've been looking all over for whatever we're looking for, and
stars.
These guys were just sitting there right around the corner.
Yeah. Cosmically speaking, they are our neighbors, and we didn't know they were there, but now we do. Hooray!
Cool. All right, well, speaking of stars, I heard you were a star on Twitter, so if I were to try to tweet at you or something on Twitter, how would I do that?
I don't know, Chris. You should probably figure out how Twitter works before you go about asking questions about how to reach people. So do you know how Twitter works? Do you have a Twitter account?
Yeah, I have a Twitter account. Do you remember
what your handle is on Twitter?
Yeah, it's at Chris Hale Barnes.
All right, well, if you ever figure out how to tweet something, you can tweet me at TaylorPhone.
Okay, I'll give that a shot right after the show. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, good.
All right, so that'll do it for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. If you'd like to send us some feedback, we are theendusr@thedigitalmediazone.com by email, or you can ping us on Twitter @TheEndUser. Join us in the chat as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Martin.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.